anyone would like to say very, very, very briefly how they found their time in the forests, all alone, braving the tigers and the lions and mad elephants. Did anyone see any tigers or lions or mad elephants?
So I heard
some. In the middle of it, I heard some roaring. Did anyone hear that roaring? You heard that too? Yeah.
The motorbike.
Yeah. That was quite frightening, wasn't it? It's really obvious how demonic it is when you're out there trying to be peaceful and suddenly you go. Did anyone notice that?
Yes.
How awful that was. But there are no accents. Anyone like to say very briefly, without having to describe anything that's too confidential and personal for them, but how they found the experience? Yes.
This is like the average day at home for me, because I live in the forest. Probably very different if you've got a family and live in the city, though, I would
think. Yeah, so for you, you do that kind of thing every day, practically speaking.
Yeah.
That's what your life is like. That's interesting. But we were trying to set up an environment that puts your consciousness deeper and deeper and more internal. And try to keep it from the external platform. So is that what your consciousness is like every day?
No.
Oh.
No, so that's the bit that was different.
That little bit.
Yeah.
Well, why don't you take that home, long as you have, Kristen's given you some unique situation where you don't have to interact. But then, of course, there has to be a balance. Because no one could do that all this time in Kali Yuga, because you find after a while that your greatest enemy is stalking you, and that's your mind with all its desires.
I think I'm lacking balance in that area.
Yeah. Well, get balanced. You know, take a step in that direction. Because, I mean, that's what it's about. Some people are lacking balance in that area, and some people are lacking balance in the exact opposite area. And just try to... And what I find most interesting, in one sense, is that everyone knows what adjustment or needs to be made in their own lives. More or less, everyone can perceive that quite simply. Thank you very much. Anyone else like to say how... Just give a very brief how they're... experience was? Yes.
It was enriching.
It was enriching. So what does enriching mean? You gain some riches. So are you going to share some of your riches with us? Or you'll be a miser? Well, what jewels did you find?
One that normally we are with the family in the town, in the city, with people around. Here it's quiet to yourself. Only with Mother Nature and chanting and thinking about the Lord. So, in that sense, it gave us an opportunity to dwell more deeper into yourself, which rarely you find such a time, such an opportunity.
Yeah. Do you find that you need some time like that in your life, actually?
Definitely.
So please consider that. Anyone else like to say? Yes.
The bit of sitting down for 1 hour.
Yeah.
I was thinking that's going to be the tough part, and then I can just roam around, do my thing.
Yeah.
But that was the easier part.
Yeah.
And then when that was over, we could walk around.
Yeah.
And there was just so many directions and so many options. The mind was feeling suddenly it had to choose.
Yeah.
So when it was just a stick and this is as far as we can get, that was easy.
When the mind had so many options. What was the experience that you had? What was the feeling or emotion that the mind had at that time?
I was thinking...
No, no.
feeling.
I'm talking about the feeling that it had, because the mind loves feelings. in one word.
I don't know, it's more or less clueless. It's just...
bewildered.
Bewildered, yeah.
The mind loves to feel bewildered. All those options that I don't know, that experience. Because we think that the mind only loves pleasure. But the mind loves even more than pleasure. Because what if the mind loved pleasure, would hold on only to the things that give it pleasure. But is that your experience, that the mind holds on to only what gives it pleasure? No, the mind holds on to any deep experience. It loves the experience of confusion and bewilderment.
I was feeling more restless at that time.
Restless, oh, that's heaven for the mind. In the mode of passion. That's the mind in the mode of passion. But what happens if you can somehow, if the mind somehow gets disciplined, and quiets down a little bit and is in the mode of goodness, it actually becomes peaceful. And sattvam, sanjayate jnanam. And actual knowledge naturally comes. How many of you found it difficult to be in your bow length? No one will admit it now. Oh yes, one person. There we have an honest man. Honest Brahmins there. Okay. Yeah, sometimes you feel trapped. Like, what am I going to do? Just imagine having to do that for 6 hours or something like that. Or a whole day. That's why, the Goswamis, they would sit in the sand. They would, practically speaking, sit in one place. For hour after hour after hour, because they were so absorbed in Krishna consciousness, their depth of Krishna consciousness was so great, the taste that they got from chanting the holy name was so great, it overcame, or the mind was so absorbed on that level, it didn't care about any other level, but the soul was being anandam bhuti vardhanam, was being bathed in nectar. Okay. One simple question. How many of you had a positive experience? What do you grab there? Okay, that's almost everyone. Thank you. Now changing the topic back to yesterday morning's first class, which was about the Avanti Brahmana. Does anyone remember anything from that class?
Which was so long ago. Who remembers something about the Avanti Brahmana other than he was from Avanti? And he ended up being poor, and therefore it's called Avanti Poor. Anyone remember anything about what happened?
He was miserly.
Raise your hand, though. Yes?
He was miserly.
He was, yes, miserly to the extreme. And then? Anyone remember anything else? Thank you. Yes?
Because of that miserliness, he became very poor, and all of his relatives left him and became bitter, and he lost his identity because he lost all his riches.
Yes. Thank you. Anyone remember anything else? Yes?
When he actually started to sing the song of the Avanti Brahmana, his first realization was that he was very unfortunate, but not because he'd lost everything, but rather that he'd been so attached to what he had.
Yes. But the actual song of the Avanti Brahmana will come now in this part. That was just his preliminary thoughts that allowed him to become detached. And quite amazing, within the dark cloud of his misfortune, he found the gold of the greatest fortune. That is part of the art of devotional service. Finding Krishna's mercy in every situation. Thank you. Anyone remember anything else? Yes.
He understood that he felt a strong feeling of renunciation.
Yes.
And he understood that is because of the mercy of the Lord.
Yes. So what can you extrapolate from that? What can you gain from that point? The strong feeling of renunciation, well, let's say it. It doesn't, these things don't come by our deepest, anything on the deepest level, it does not come from my personal power. No matter how personally powerful, how much personal power we have, it is actually, first of all, a gift, and second, it is insignificant compared to Krishna's material energy. We have strength. And then a tidal wave comes and boom, tsunami, finish. There's no such thing as good health in this world. There's no such thing as strength in this world. In 1 second, anything could be gone. So really, what we have, especially if it's an opulence, an ability that's strong, it's a gift of Krishna. And he is maintaining it for us. And if we become proud about that, about a gift, we are certainly foolish. And also we'll end up being ungrateful. And then we'll have to taste the bitter pill of the ashes of losing it. So everything will be taken away from us at the time of death. We lose it. And that's what one of the main difficulties of becoming old is, because all the upadis, all the things that you think are you but actually aren't you, that you're proud of and you identify, this is me and I'm better than this one because of that, one by one, they're all taken away, hair by hair, one could even say, from personal experience, or tooth by tooth, I can also say that one too. Whatever, it's all taken away. And then I just recently had a tooth extracted, and then the dentist said, do you want to see it? So usually I would say, no, I don't want to see it at all, because you know, they're not pretty at all. But this time I was in a philosophical mood. So I said, yes, I want to see it. I'd not rather have it here. So showed it to me, and there it was. And I thought, it's not me, because I'm still here and the tooth is over there. And usually I thought, by looking back, I said, this is me. But that tooth wasn't me, and my ear isn't me, and this isn't me. So all the things that we think are us, but aren't us, are taken away from us. And then, and if we don't know who we really are, if we think we're the ability, that ability to run is me, or if we think this ability, it's just so disappointing if we don't know who we are, as we lose our sense of identity, so to speak, piece by tooth by tooth. Okay, we should move on with, because today there's so much excitement planned. Now, the Avanti Brahmana, and I've seen this in life, I have a very deep realization, all Krishna, as I mentioned yesterday, all I want is to serve you, and you know, from now on I don't care about anything else other than service to you. And it's almost as if you hear Krishna saying, oh really? Let's see. So the Avanti Brahmana, he had a very deep realization. I don't want to have anything to do with this material world. I will be situated in the self alone. And now he's going to be tested. From 32 to 61, that's the entire chapter. How many verses? See if any of you How many verses will we read today? Can any of you do this without your mobile phones, computers?
29.
29. 29. Huh? It's really, life is rough without your mobile phone, isn't it?
29.
Today's the 30th.
Okay. So this is a summary. He wandered about the earth, keeping his intelligence, senses, and life air under control. To beg charity, this is text 32, he traveled alone to various cities and villages. He did not advertise his advanced spiritual position, and thus was not recognized by others. O kind Uddhav, seeing him as an old, dirty beggar, rowdy persons would dishonor him with many insults. This is the level of because one can only be externally tolerant to the level that one is internally deep. So this talks about his external tolerance and the depth of his internal taking shelter. Some of those persons, this is how they treated him, and he was just wandering around a beggar, a mendicant, would take away his sannyas rod and some the water pot which he was using as a begging bowl. Some took his deerskin seat, some his chanting beads, and some would steal his torn, ragged clothing. Displaying these things before him, they would pretend to offer them back, but would then hide them again. When he was sitting on the bank of a river about to partake of the food that he had collected by his begging, such sinful rascals would come and pass urine on it, and they would dare to spit on his head. Although he had taken a vow of silence, they would try to make him speak. And if he did not speak, they would beat him with sticks. Others would chastise him, saying, "This man is just a thief. He's pretending to be a beggar and a holy man. He's just a thief." And others would bind him with rope, shouting, "Tie him up! Tie him up!" They would criticize and insult him, saying, "This man is just a hypocrite and a cheat. He makes a business of religion simply because he lost all his wealth and his family threw him out." Some would ridicule him by saying, "Just see this greatly powerful sage. He's as steadfast as the Himalayan mountains. By practice of silence, he strives for his goal with great determination, just like a duck." Other persons would pass foul air upon him, and sometimes others would bind this twice-born Brahmana in chains and keep him captive like a pet animal. And then this 40th text. Gopal Vilas Prabhu, please read the Sanskrit. And everyone follow along. Follow after you read it, each line.
Evam sa bhautikam dukham.
Evam sa bhautikam dukham.
Daivikam daivikam chayat.
Daivikam daivikam chayat.
Bhoktavyam atmanodishtam.
Bhoktavyam atmanodishtam.
Praptam praptam abuddhyadayata.
Praptam praptam abuddhyadayata.
So thus, he saw all the different miseries. Bhautikam dukham. Dukham, of course, miseries. Bhautikam, caused by other persons, by daiva, by dahikam. Dahikam and daiva. Daiva means by how would you translate it? Due to the higher powers and due to his own body. So our threefold miseries. He saw all of these. All of these he saw dishtam. All this suffering he saw allotted to him by his own fortune or fate. And whatever he received, he understood in that way. Whatever happened to him, on whatever level, whatever misery, all those disgraceful things that occurred to him, he saw as this has happened to me by fate, by providence. And he accepted it. And he did not try to fight it. The Brahmana, understanding all his suffering from other living beings, from the higher forces of nature, and from his own body, was unavoidable, being allotted to him by providence. So even while being insulted by these low-class men who were trying to effect his downfall, he remained steady in his spiritual duties. Just imagine how deep his realization and his taking shelter of Krishna must have been, that he was able to remain steady throughout all of that, those descriptions that we just heard of how he was treated. And remember that this is in response Krishna's words, Krishna's telling this pastime, is in response to Uddhava's question that that person's nature, his conditioned nature, is so strong. Is it even possible to transcend it? And here is Krishna's answer. That, and Uddhava also answered the same question too. Krishna said, by intelligence you can do it, by the power of intelligence. And Uddhava said, by the power of the depth of devotion to your lotus feet, one can actually do it. And now here is the example, the story of someone who actually did it. Now, is he doing this by the power of his intelligence or the power of his devotion? That will be clearly stated very soon. Here it appears almost like a jnana type of practice. You know, I'm just detached. Everything is my fate. It's coming. It's starting. You know, it's something born of the intelligence, a very powerful intelligence. But actually, that is not what's going on at all. But in any case, he remains so fixed, and he is an object of our worship, the Avanti Brahmana. And generally speaking, when in the Gaudiya Sampradaya, and Srila Prabhupada did this also, when awarding sannyas, this verse that will come very soon, and the example of giving was that Mahaprabhu took, is of the Avanti Brahmana. This is the perfection, complete detachment from the externals of the world, and a complete deep absorption in the shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this allows one the topmost realization and the topmost. Topmost realization means the topmost service. It always is going to be service because we're always servants, because Ekala Ishvara Krishna Asava Britya. He is the master and we are always servants. So this gives us access to the topmost service. How much humility one has to have. So this is so exalted consciousness. So he remains steady in his spiritual duties. Fixing his resolution in the mode of goodness, he began to chant the following song. So these verses, we won't cover them all in detail here, the song of the actual song, of the Avanti Brahmana from 42 to 57. So first from 42 to 49, or almost the whole song are his realizations about the mind, the nature of the mind, and what is the actual cause of suffering. And then the essence of the song is saved for the end. And where is the shelter for the soul? If it's not the mind, where is the soul's shelter? So first, and this is more or less the summary, this first verse is more or less the summary of the first part of the points that he's making. The Brahman said, these people, and he would sing this song in the midst of all the tribulations and difficulties and insults and inconveniences that he encountered in his life. He would sing this song in his mind continuously, and this kept him on track, just like the devotees continuously sing the Hare Krishna Mahamantra in every circumstance at all times. Yes? Yes? We try. That's our goal, certainly. These people are not the cause of my happiness and distress. Neither are the demigods. My own body, the planets, my past work, or time. Later on, in the last verses, he'll go over this, each one of those, and explain the reasons. We won't go over them in full detail. These people are not the cause of my happiness and distress. The causes are not external at all. The demigods, my own body, the planets, my past work, or time, even karma, he's saying, isn't the cause of happiness and distress. Rather, he says, it is the mind alone. It is the mind alone that causes happiness and distress and perpetuates the rotation of material life. This is philosophically described, I had mentioned it before, by the Hansa Avatar in the 11th canto, 13th chapter. How the whole, what we perceive as reality is not reality. If there's an automobile accident and there are 13 witnesses and you ask what happened and you'll get 13 different opinions, and generally speaking, each person will think, I see it, saw it right, and that person has it wrong, everyone else has it wrong. I mean, that's what the material world is like. Because no one is seeing reality, everyone is seeing something of reality mixed or covered by the overlay of their own consciousness, their own mind. And what is reality in one sense? The Hansa Avatar explains, it is me, it is Krishna. So unless one is seeing Krishna in every circumstance, because the Absolute Truth, the definition of the Absolute Truth, is that which is all inclusive, nothing is external to it. So if there is an Absolute Truth, if we see something external to it, then we are not seeing the Absolute Truth. Because nothing is external to the Absolute Truth. So anyway, when we see this material world, when we see something that is, this is the cause of my misery, and this is the cause of my misery, this is the cause of my happiness, and this, and this, and this. We are missing out on reality. And what we are doing is simply, the soul, through false ego, is interacting with the, with his mind. So this is the point that he's making. It's a devotional point, but it's a jnana type of a point too. It comes from the intellectual platform or deep philosophical understanding. So listen to what he says about the mind. Please listen. Now, yes, try and ask your mind if it will please listen to this instruction. The powerful mind actuates the functions of the material modes from which evolve the different kinds of material activities in the modes of goodness, ignorance, and passion. There's Bhagavatam class after Bhagavatam class that can be given on these points. It's very technical and it's quite wonderful and fascinating, but it's not for now. From the activities of each of these modes develop corresponding statuses of life, basically and simply, based on what fills the mind. The next body comes. Krishna says this in the Bhagavad Gita, adhisthaya manasthaya visya upasevate. Based on what fills the mind, we get a next body. Although present along with the struggling mind within the material body, the super soul is there, but he is not endeavoring. The soul, fully identifying through false ego with the mind, is endeavoring continuously to find happiness and to push away distress and bring more happiness and push away distress. This is what material life is. And based on that, this person I like and this person I don't like. Does this person bring me happiness? Does this person bring me distress? It's all based on the mind's discrimination based on false ego, because the mind wanting to squeeze pleasure from the material existence where there's actually no pleasure for the soul at all. But the super soul is right there. But he is not on this quest of squeezing pleasure from the material world. He is not endeavoring, even though he's right there, because he's already endowed with transcendental enlightenment. And he is there acting as my friend. He simply witnesses from his transcendental position, I, the infinitesimal spirit soul, on the other hand, have embraced this mind. Embracing the mind, we fully identify with the mind's thoughts as me. And what is the mind? So he embracing the material mind, which is the mirror reflecting the image of the material world. We don't, through the mind, we get the reflection of reality. We don't get reality. Did you ever try to eat a feast when you're hungry through the mirror? Well, that's what it's like trying to enjoy the material world. You see it right there in front of you. But you can't get the flavor, the rasa that you want. So frustrating. So frustrating. Therefore, one of the most difficult period in life, in one sense, is when you're a teenager. I mean, especially in the West, because you're presented with all the possibilities in front of you. The whole mirror is there, and you just want to get out there and enjoy it all. Because you have unlimited energy and you have unlimited desires. And you just want to experience and taste everything. So it's the most frustrating thing Because even though you want to taste everything, you're only a tiny insignificant soul, or even in one material body, you know, and how much can you do, especially with your parents there? So it's so frustrating. And then as we get older, we go through different stages of frustration. This is not... And even the devotees, we have to have whatever lingering material tendencies, which mean the same thing, the mind reflecting out and trying to enjoy, they have to be burnt away. And then by the time one's old, that the frustration of having unlimited possibilities turns into the cynicism and dryness of having no possibilities, and what do I do with life, you know? And then you look at the young people, you know, with cynicism mixed with envy, you know. I've watched this. I've mentioned this many times already, but it's so important. I've watched this in myself the best example for me is when I was young, I could run all day long. I could run for 5, 6, 7 hours. And now my ankle hurts and my knee hurts. Well, I can't even, it's easier for me to name what doesn't hurt than what does hurt. And I can't think of anything. Oh yeah, my right wrist. But so then when you're older, you start seeing young people, and they're running, or young boys and girls together, and romances in their heart, and you start thinking, I remember when I could run. You start thinking, I remember when I was young and my skin wasn't wrinkly. I remember this. And then you start thinking, if only I could run again. Because it looks like so much pleasure. And it's effortless. If only I could run again. So it sounds so innocent, but you're placing seeds for your next birth right into your heart. Oh, you want to run again? How many legs would you like next time? I see these little millipedes that are everywhere. Are they here also? They're everywhere. I don't know. But they really must have had that desire. Only if I had 1,000 legs, I could walk and walk and walk. So we should be very careful, extremely careful with what desires we fill our consciousness with. Because material desires, innocent as they may seem, are not actually innocent, because they cause us repeated birth and death. And that means suffering. So, thus, he says, I have become engaged in enjoying objects of desire. We actually never, I heard Prabhupada recently say in a lecture, that we don't actually enjoy the object, the thing that we think we're enjoying. We're just, all we end up doing is touching the modes of material nature, dealing with the modes of material nature. So we're just enjoying the modes of material nature, or suffering the modes of material nature. So thus, I become engaged in enjoying objects of desire, and I'm entangled due to contact with the modes of nature. Charity, prescribed duties, observance of major and minor regulative principles, hearing from scriptures, pious works, and purifying vows, all have as their final aim the subduing of the mind, the controlling of the mind. And this is actually the job of youth, because it gets almost impossible if one doesn't do it in youth. becomes almost impossible as one gets older. It's to control the senses and to control the mind. This is the purpose of life until one is 25, 27, 30 years old. Up to 25 especially. Now, this is not what we are taught in school. It's rather just the opposite. Let your senses go. The world is possibilities. There's the internet. You need 100 TV channels, and then there's this and that. Fill your consciousness with as much as possible and suffer for the rest of it. And the result is just that with the contempt with people. So much suffering. No peace. So the purpose of all this is to subdue the mind, all the pious activities. Indeed, and here's where we're starting to get to the point, the perfect point, indeed, concentration of the mind on the Supreme is the highest goal. So detachment of the mind from its purpose of enjoying the senses and full absorption on the Supreme Lord, that is the highest yoga. If one's mind is perfectly fixed and pacified, then tell me, this is the song he was singing. Now this would not be a popular song nowadays. If one's mind is perfectly fixed and pacified, then tell me, what need does one have to perform ritualistic charity and other pious rituals? And if one's mind remains uncontrolled, lost in ignorance, then of what use are these engagements for him? All the senses, listen to this one, all the senses have been under the control of the mind since time immemorial. And the mind himself never comes under the sway of any other. What does that mean? Who could translate that? And who can say that in another way? Yes.
The mind does not want to be controlled.
Okay. The mind, is that the same as the mind himself never comes under the sway of any other? Is that the same as the mind does not want to be controlled? The mind refuses. It never comes under the influence. It wants to do what it wants to do. He is stronger than the strongest, and his godlike power is fearsome. Therefore, anyone who can bring the mind under control becomes the master of all the senses. And failing to conquer this irrepressible enemy, the mind, who's, this is quite depressing, isn't it? Oh no, what will become of me? What will become of me? Oh. Failing to conquer this irrepressible enemy, the mind, whose urges are intolerable and who torments the heart, many people are completely bewildered and create useless quarrel with others. This is what happens with the mind. This is like the definition of Kali Yuga. 7 billion minds all quarreling with each other. And that's not including the animals and the insects and the birds and the monkeys. And I've studied the monkeys very carefully. That's all they do, quarrel. There's big families of monkeys, one here, and they're always wandering from one place to the next, and they're looking for food, and the big groups fight each other. And the biggest monkeys, and all the little monkeys, they all go, and don't know if you've ever seen this. They all get there and support, but the real fight is, and they go like this, but they don't fight each other. But then the big monkeys come out. You know those ones like this, who look like they've been in the gym all the time? They come out like that, and they're ferocious. And then the biggest monkeys from both sides, they come and fight each other. And they run after each other. And this is what monkeys do all day long. That's why they're brave, because they fight all day long. So fighting for them is nothing. That's what they do all day long. And they're ripped, their faces are ripped, and their arms and tails. Please, don't become a monkey. We'll start on dogs in a moment, because I've also studied the dogs in Vrindavan too. But this is what Kali Yuga is like. It's just all these minds and different bodies just thinking that our group, our mind, ours, me, like that. All full identification with mind, body, and senses. Creating useless quarrels, bewildered with others, and suffering so much. Thus they conclude that other people are their friends, other monkey groups are their friends, their enemies or parties indifferent to them. I'll tell you some other monkey secrets. That at one time of the day, the monkeys around noontime, just around noon, something earlier than noon and then till maybe 3 or 4, the monkeys all become quiet and peaceful and tired. Did you notice that? Anyone know the Visya? And then they just need a place to rest for a while, and then the families don't fight. Because the families, they fight other big families, but when they're not fighting the other families, they're fighting amongst themselves. Like all families. Interfamily politics. They're always fighting amongst themselves. The only thing that stops them is either they're fighting other bigger families, or it's 12 o'clock. So at 12 o'clock they stop fighting each other, and everyone takes rest. The little children go play palm trees, and everyone else picks lice from each other very peacefully, and sleep. And at that time, if you walk near them, they go like this. They look the other way. And that means I'm not bothering you, don't bother me. But they don't just look the other way, they look the other way because they're dealing with humans, and they go like this. Have you seen this? You all become monkey scientists. And now I'll reveal two glories of monkeys. One is in the family. This is the third thing that unites monkey groups. If anyone gives trouble to one of the baby monkeys, the whole family will come together, especially the biggest monkeys, and they will give that person trouble to protect their baby monkey. So I think that's glorious. Second thing is that when they all come together, and the baby monkeys, they make a sound. I can't do it right now. But they make this special sound, which means they're being bothered. And then the whole family immediately comes, like the whole thing, and everyone gets ferocious to protect them. And the second thing is, you can fight with them, you can throw rocks at them, and they'll be angry at you, and you can pick up a stick, and they'll go like this, and everything like that. And then 5 minutes later, they've forgotten about it completely. They let it go so quickly. Anything that disturbs them, they just let it go. So those are the, from what I've seen, the two glorious qualities of monkeys, monkey families. So they conclude that other people are either their friends, their enemies, or parties indifferent to them. Persons who identify with this body, which is simply the product of the material mind, are blinded in their intelligence, thinking in terms of I and mine. Because of their illusion of this is I, but that is someone else, they wander in endless darkness. So first he's spoken about the mind. So he's spoken about the ferocious nature of the mind, that the mind is at the essence of material existence. And then he's going to speak about the false causes of suffering that he mentioned in the beginning. We won't go over all of them right now. We'll go over them just in very, very brief. But he gives a verse describing that at whom should one become angry for causing our suffering? Other people? Happiness and distress are like the biting of the tongue by one's own teeth. The demigods, the soul's own nature, fruit of work, the body, time. Actually, so he one by one, he'll give a verse explaining philosophically why each and every one of those aren't the cause of our distress. Usually, we point to other people as the distress, our karma, the demigods, or it's the nature of the soul to be happiness, if to have happiness in distress, obviously it's not thinking of the soul as eternal. Our fruit of work, the body, oh, of course I must be experiencing distress because the body is, it's like that. It's my body that gives me trouble. Oh, time gives me trouble. But actually, he says, the soul is transcendental. And it has nothing to do with matter. It has nothing to do with happiness and distress. Its actual life is on a different level. The soul's existence is on a completely different level. And there is the potency of Maya that disallows the soul to experience its true nature on that level. And it is Krishna's Maya. So, the soul covered by Maya is seeking, according to the mind, to enjoy this. Enjoy that. Exploit this. Gain this. Find happiness here. Push away distress. This is what material existence means. It's really that simple. Regardless of the body, the most primitive millipede body or the most intellectual body, the same principles govern. I want to enjoy, I don't want to suffer, but it's all based on the mind and the body. Nothing to do with the soul. So what spiritual life means is the soul's awakening to its true nature. Sarupena avastita mukti anyatya rupas anyatya rupam, no other, it gives up every other identity and becomes situated in his own self. Mukti becomes, self-realization becomes becoming who you are. It means becoming who we are. Everyone is, everyone in a material body is always feeling some sort of discomfort because we are, we're not who we are, so to speak. Well, we are who we're not. But true liberation means becoming who we actually are, and it means liberation from illusion and living in the soul's true glory. That is what it means to be a transcendentalist. So there are the impersonalist transcendentalists who say that means just becoming one with everything, and yet they are considered transcendentalists. And then there's the devotee transcendentalist, who means being situated as Krishna's servant, either in Vaikuntha or Goloka Vrindavan. So the question naturally comes, and it's how do you go from here to there? And how do you know that there is really there? How do we know it's truly in existence? How do we know it's just not some story coming from some old land? And the answer is, there's so many answers to that. And the most powerful answer is, join the kirtan. And this is Mahaprabhu's special gift, because there is such a taste that is not of this world, that you cannot find in this world. Go to the holy land of Vrindavan. And if you can just get some good guidance, part a little bit of the externals, and just see and experience that there is something obviously behind the curtain. This tirtha, a holy place, what it literally means is a threshold. Just like the doorway. Vaishnava Trump, stand up for a second and open the door. And stand in the doorway. Open the door wider. I think we might have to move. Yeah. So stand right in the doorway. Now, no. Right? Exactly. Yes. Now, are you in the room or outside of the room? You're in the doorway. That's threshold. That is what a tirtha, a holy place is. It's not. You can keep the door, but you can come in now. A little fresh air, never hurt. It's like someone may not have access into the full room, into the full spiritual world, but the holy dham is a place where you can perceive the existence of the spiritual world, even though you might not be fully in it. But you can walk through. You know it's there. You feel it so close that you don't have the ability to walk through and enter into it. But you know it's there. That's what the potency of the holy dhammas. And then when you combine the association of devotees, and we saw this with Prabhupada, whether he was in Vrindavan or whether he was in Melbourne or whether he was in New York, he carried Vrindavan with him. So when you put the holy place with the holy names, with the holy devotees, and the Bhagavatam, and their lordships, and you chant Hare Krishna together, then the spiritual world manifests. For everyone, even for a few moments, even if one is a beginner, so many, I've seen this, I remember there's this one devotee brought a group of Chinese yoga students to Vrindavan. And he was teaching them yoga and this and that in Vrindavan. And then he got them to chant, start chanting on beads the Hare Krishna Mahamantra as part of the yoga practice. They never had anything to do with Krishna consciousness. They had no idea of anything Krishna consciousness. And half of them just started crying. And then they see, you see the deities. There's a famous story. Anyway, we could go on and on. But these items are so powerful. And Mahaprabhu said all of them should be accompanied by the holy name. So powerful. So it gives us the strength to go on. And the more we absorb ourselves in these things, and the more we facilitate the absorption of others in these things, the more mercy we get, and the more Krishna's blessings come to us. So even if, because I mentioned that other verse yesterday about sarva harati tito sto bhagavan purushottama, that in Kali Yuga, dravyadeshatpasambhavam, everything is Kali Kridan Dosham. Everything in Kali Yuga, everyone's minds are so contaminated. Every person is contaminated. So by bringing the Lord in our heart in these ways, and the more we can keep Him in our heart, all the contaminations of Kali Yuga are removed. So now, he explains the essence of his song and the essence of his spiritual practice and the essence of that which gives him the power to control his mind, to be tolerant, and to be focused always internally. And this is the verse that is generally told to sannyasis at the time of their taking of sannyas. Please, and everyone chant along after.
Etam saastaya paratmanishtham.
Etam saastaya paratmanishtham.
Adhyasitam purvatamer mahashibhihi.
Adhyasitam purvatamer mahashibhihi.
Aham tarishyami duranta param.
Aham tarishyami duranta param.
Tamo mukuntam krinishevayaiva.
Tamo mukuntam krinishevayaiva.
Can we do it without the translation?
I can cross over the insurmountable ocean of material existence.
Do it by word by word.
Being fixed in the first line. Being fixed in the Paratmanasha, being fixed in the Supreme Lord.
The Ashtaya means fixed, and Paratmanistam, that fixedness in the Paratattva, the Supreme Lord.
Adhyasitam purva tamer mahashivi. It is the path followed by the previous sages.
Maharishivi. This is the path that all the previous sages followed. Being fixed of consciousness in the Supreme Lord.
Aham tarishyami duranta param tamo. That is, I will cross over the insurmountable ocean of material existence.
So, you're going to cross over. If something's insurmountable, by definition, you can't cross it over. Cross over it. And that is what the material world is. Maya duratya. It is not possible to cross over by yourself. But in this way, one can cross over the insurmountable ocean.
by devotion service unto the lotus feet of Mukunda.
So, Mukundangri means the lotus feet of Mukunda. So somehow or another, holding on always, continuously to the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, of Lord Mukunda, whose face, who is the giver of liberation, whose face, his mukh, is blossoming like a kunda flower. If we can hold on to his lotus feet, which is the path, this is the paratma, this is the supreme absolute truth. And if we can hold on to his lotus feet, we shall certainly cross over this insurmountable ocean of material suffering and miseries. Certainly. And this is the path that is given by the previous acharyas, and this is the path that he has adopted. And this gives him the strength to be able to tolerate and to become detached. It is not his own intelligence. It is not the path of jnana. It is not coming from his own potency, intellectual potency. It is because he has taken shelter of Krishna so deeply, completely, to the very core of himself, he is Krishna's. And there is no other way to cross over. Of course, there's the mercy factor. But for the purpose of this is the methodology. A full giving of oneself to Krishna. I am yours. And then, when one matures in Krishna, I am yours, and the relationship grows, then what even becomes more dominant is Krishna, you are mine. And that's more the mood in me now. But unless first I say, Gotirpte Varanam Tata, Krishna, I'm yours. I'm yours now, I'm your servant. I'm completely under your protection and maintenance. That gives one the ability to say, to feel protected by Krishna. And then gradually feel that it gives one like, that's the membership card into Krishna's group, so to speak. And then that allows one to feel oneself that Krishna is yours, because you're giving yourself to him, and he's such a kind master, kind Lord. I shall cross over the insurmountable ocean of nescience by being firmly fixed in the service of the lotus feet of Krishna. This was approved by the previous acharyas, who were fixed in firm devotion to the Lord Paramatma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So that's the end of the Brahmana's song. Two main parts of it. There's no cause of trouble other than the mind, and let me take shelter. What to do when the mind is giving me trouble, pointing this way and that? There's only one answer, and that is to take shelter of the lotus feet of Krishna. Krishna, I'm yours. Please save me. Please protect me. Allow me to serve you. Please make this consciousness focused on Krishna. So Lord Krishna, after saying this, he said, thus becoming detached upon the loss of his property, the sage gave up his moroseness. He left home, taking sannyas, and began to travel about the earth. Even when insulted by foolish rascals, he remained unswerved from his duty and chanted this song. No other force beside his own mental confusion makes the soul experience happiness and distress. Because there is no happiness and distress for the eternal soul. That's all on the material level. The soul is transcendental to that. So it's the hankar, or the mind's confusion, that causes the soul to experience the happiness and distress is as if it's happening to him. Somewhat a jnana type of perception Krishna's explaining here, because it's coming from previous chapter was a jnana type of a chapter. His perceptions of friends, neutral parties, and enemies, and the whole material life he builds around this perception are simply created out of ignorance. And then finally, Tasmat Savat Manatata Nigrahana Manodhya Maya Aveshitaya Yukta Etavan Yoga Samgraha.
Etavan Yoga Samgraha.
My dear Uddhava, fixing your intelligence on me. So that's actually the putting together of the two concepts of the intelligence and the devotion is use your intelligence and focus your intelligence upon Krishna. And you should thus completely control the mind. And this is the essence of the science of yoga. Anyone who listens to or recites to others the song of the sannyasi, which presents scientific knowledge of the absolute. Now what benediction is going to happen here for us all? Because we have all either listened to or heard or spoken or both. Now what is the benediction that we are going to receive right now? And who thus meditates upon it with full attention, one has to think deeply, will never again be overwhelmed by the dualities of material happiness and distress. One has to be deep. And that's the end of this chapter. Now remember, before we'll break now, but just this one point of this is in life balancing, right? And this he's gone from here to completely on this side. So this is one type of an example. And again, there's so much we learn from him, but it's not an example that we will follow. We will speak some more in the next part of the presentation, which will be, say, what's the exact time right now? Okay, so we'll meet again at 15:15, and then we'll have the remaining parts of the presentation from then until the end. First, we'll have some practical guidelines based on the theory that we spoke about yesterday. Some practical guidelines that if anyone wants to try to adopt this simple life balancing adjusting techniques, to try to make it very, very, very practical. So I have three suggestions. And my one of them that won't be a suggestion exactly, I'll say now, is that I'm hoping some devotees will want to try this for 1 month and see if it's helpful. So we'll discuss that. And then we're going to have a second example of a person, not the Avanti Brahmana, who we also shouldn't follow his example, but we can learn many lessons from him. Okay, go. But come back exactly on time, please. 15:15. Breathe, take rest if you have to, and because there are so many exciting things we have planned for the last hour. How did you...